Mark, as you probably all know, was a very senior, he was head of public policy for EMEA at Uber, the source for the Guardian's Uber Files series, which laid bare the company's kind of entry into and bending the rules of, or breaking the law in, as you would say, many different countries when it comes to workers' rights, drivers' rights. And yeah, I mean, that series ultimately, I think it was how many journalists were involved in the
180
journalists at many different publications all across the world. So a really like broad scale of disclosures from one of the highest echelons of a company that we've ever seen become a whistleblower. Daniel is someone from a very different part of the tech economy, but no less of an important one. Daniel was a content moderator for Facebook based out of Kenya. He was actually an outsourced content moderator working for a so-called ethical AI company called Sama. For those of you who don't know, content moderation is a very traumatic job that involves looking at content on Facebook, Twitter, social media websites that breaks the rules of those sites and takes that content down before all of you, all of us, have to see it. So all of the content that gets reported flows to either Daniel or ultimately an AI that is trained by people like Daniel. So Daniel was in 2019 working, doing this job for a wage of, was it $2.20 an hour, something like that?
Yes.
Got involved in an organizing effort with himself and more than 100 of his colleagues, at which point the outsourcing company fired him for what they said was putting their business relationship with Facebook at risk, I believe.
Yes.
So yeah, both very different parts of the tech economy, but united in many ways, but one in the sense that they both blew the whistle on what they believed were fundamental violations of workers' rights, and two, that they were both supported by the Signals Network, which for Mark, he was telling me his first call with the Signals Network was 1 hour, 2 hours before you were revealed, 1 hour before he was revealed as the source of the Guardian's investigation. No. Yeah, don't do that. Daniel is much more of a good case study here. I asked Delphine from the Signals Network a few weeks in advance of the story for advice in how to deal with a source who was very keen, in fact, to blow the whistle. We didn't face any issues of you kind of being scared to do it.
I had nothing to lose.
Yeah, but the power differential, like he says, was so great that we figured it was prudent to try and work around issues of public of your own safety, as well as the trauma, the undiagnosed post-traumatic stress disorder that Daniel had been dealing with for many years at that point as a result of the work that he had to do every day. That was only diagnosed actually after the Signals Network kindly paid for a therapist who I believe you're still in touch with today, is that right?
Yes. Yes.
So anyway, that's enough from me. Mark, I wonder if we could start with you. I'm less familiar with your case than I am with Daniel's. Why don't you tell everybody about your journey from being inside a tech company and your realizations and ultimately blowing the whistle?
Yeah, I'll try and make it short. And thanks to everybody for showing up on this cold, rainy day. I guess one never has the ambition to be a whistleblower. It's not something you dream about being when you grow up. And with regards to Uber, the first thing I made clear is I was never some sort of innocent bystander and then speaking out saying, well, look at what he did or look what she did. You know, I was part of a system. I was part of a company. I was the face of the company across Europe, Middle East, and Africa, running over 50 countries, you know, forced to have bodyguard protection 24/7. But it was the Silicon Valley dream at the time that we were, you know, we were infused with this sense of purpose. Uber was mostly really good people working very, very hard. But the hype, the hubris, and the overdosing on the Kool-Aid led to us basically selling a lie to drivers. And after leaving the company and moving on with my life, you know, COVID hit, and like many people I'm sure here, I had a lot of time on my hands and a lot of time to reflect. And I held up a mirror, and, you know, from talking to a lot of Uber drivers in many parts of the world, and being somebody who's naturally very chatty and inquisitive, I really realized that what we termed at the time driver economics, it wasn't actually panning out for the drivers that we planned. You know, we had three different narratives for three different audiences, you know, to investors, to the venture capital world, that were throwing money at us with no conditions attached. We were saying, you know, hand over the billions and we will give you a better return than you've ever seen in the shorter period of time than you've ever experienced. We were saying to consumers, citizens, what we call riders, you know, this is the best way to get around your city. Forget the dirty, expensive, corrupt taxi industry. You know, we will give you the best service at the cheapest price, your own private driver. And we were saying to drivers, you know, women and men, who were essential in order for the entire project to function. We call them our partner drivers. Internally, we call them supply. We said, you know, you can really, you know, be your own boss, be an entrepreneur, self-employed. You can really make a really good living. And we were saying that to a population that was mostly, you know, not, you know, no university degrees, first, second generation immigrants in many countries, including here in London. And so the three different narratives, it just didn't add up. And lo and behold, as we prepared for the IPO, we removed the massive subsidies that we'd used, those investor billions, to price dump, to acquire market share, to subsidize the rides. We hiked up the commission on drivers. We put all these spurious new costs, such as safe rides fees. We laid the responsibility for VAT at the foot of the drivers, not of the company. And over time, you know, realized that the drivers were really getting it in the neck. And I guess one day I just held up a mirror and I said, that's just wrong. And it may sound slightly twee, it may sound altruistic, but I realized that no one else was speaking up. And as I said, back at the time, the Guardian and ICIJ and partners released a whole flurry of stories that hopefully there's not a statute of limitations on doing the right thing. You know, I spoke up late. Inside the company, had I spoken up at the time, putting aside the fact that I actually believed in the mission, I believed in what we were selling at the time, it was not the kind of culture where, you know, best idea wins. If you challenged a company where it was really machismo, it was the bro culture, it was the cult of the personality with the founder, you'd be shown the door. So it took me a while to realize that I had played a part in selling this lie, and I needed to own my responsibilities. And when I look at how platform workers have been treated, you know, people who drive us from A to B, people who deliver us our food, Uber Eats, you know, Deliveroo, in this kind of weather, these people in many countries are not even getting the statutory minimum wage, and they have no basic social protections. And I just realized that was wrong, and I had to play some sort of part in trying to, you know, rebalance the equation.
Daniel, how does that story sound to you? It sounds quite different from your whistleblower story. I wonder if you could tell everybody about your kind of your journey.
Okay, my journey. How does? So my journey has been a very difficult one, mostly because I ended up having PTSD because of doing this work. And now, as I sit, because sometimes I ask myself, if I had known, would I have taken the job? That's the bigger question that I ask myself. And the reason for that is because I'm coming from a very poor background. So, and I always say poverty is really not a beautiful thing. is something that actually people want to run away from. You don't want poverty. Hence, I ask myself the question. But at the end of the day, I think I would have chosen life, because living with PTSD is not really, it's not life. I was not living because at some point I was actually contemplating death because of this job. Before going to Kenya, working as a quantum moderator, I was actually a very ambitious person. I went to university, Rhodes University. It's a really prestigious university by many means in our country, maybe internationally as well. And the plan was to, okay, I need to build a career, get a good job, and take my family out of poverty. I go to Kenya, I'm not told that, look, the job that you're... Okay, right now, before we began here, I got a question. What is content moderation? No one actually knows what content moderation is, even now. So I've been speaking about this for, I don't even remember how long now. And no one knows still. Back then, the situation was even worse for me, because you couldn't even Google something and find out what content moderation actually is. So I went to Kenya not knowing that I'm actually going to be moderating online user-generated content. That's content that has been generated by users on social media platforms. I didn't even know that I was actually going to be working for a social media company, Facebook. I only knew that I was going to do content moderation. What was that? Well, I connected the dots. You moderate content. What kind of content? Well, maybe you open a book or tests, exams, or whatever, you moderate that. Turns out I was wrong. I get there, I get a contract, which really didn't explain anything still. I signed, and at that time, remember the pressure of poverty that I'm talking about. I am running away from poverty. I'm trying to make money to make sure that I actually build a life for myself, and the expectation is someone coming from university in Africa or maybe a poor country, so to speak, is such that you should take your family out of poverty. So the plan is do that. So I get there. They drop me into this thing they call training. It's not even training by any measure. It's actually induction, because I did that for 2 weeks. It's just that they show you how to use Facebook systems and how you moderate content. I think I was in a slightly better position, and I'm not going to say compared to everyone else. I did Bachelor of Arts. I majored in law. So at least I have some level of understanding in terms of how you deal with policy. Right. For the most part, they get people from the street to moderate this content using what? Facebook's policy. So essentially what you do is that as a content moderator, you have to interpret policy against content. And it's something that actually requires training, which is why the system is failing. Again, there was a question about porn, which was not removed. The system is broken. And now I haven't even said anything about it, but let me address this first. I haven't said anything about, I haven't finished my chain. So the system is broken. If you are going to take someone, and I'm not suggesting that this is a problem that has been created by content moderators. It is really not our fault. It is the fault of the owners of these platforms. They're not interested in coming up with a better system that, one, works for content moderators, two, that works for users as well, and three, a system that will basically also work for them as well. So it's a broken system, it's a non-existent system, because there isn't even consensus in terms of how to moderate content. So if you are taking me from the street, I have no training whatsoever in terms of interpreting policy, best believe I'm going to get it wrong, possibly. Because even the trainers themselves, so I used to argue with some of the people that they were bringing from Silicon Valley. They would come to do this training of theirs. And then I'd be like, but that doesn't mean that. That is not supposed to be applied in that way. But because they were coming from, I don't know, sometimes I felt like, okay, because I'm coming from a third world country, maybe I'm seen as not good enough. And in fact, that was the general feeling I had, because for the most part, we were told that they are doing us a favor. Without them, we wouldn't actually have the job. So if we try and go against them, they'll simplify us and go and get someone else from the street. And it is that simple to actually replace a content moderator, even today, because there is no certification program of sorts. So it's like there is a lot of supply. It's just there. It's not limited. So if you want to replace a content moderator, just go in the street, pick someone else who knows how to click, use a computer, read, or maybe understand a certain language, and then hire them. So that is the situation, of which is why the system fails. So if it's not removed, it's not removed really for two reasons. One, it's either I as a content moderator got it wrong, but not because I wanted to get it wrong. I simply do not have the necessary training to do this. Two, they don't have a proper system for actually removing content, of which is why there's a lot of information out there and people going to, countries going to war, people attempting suicide because of the sort of content that they come across. And the third reason is that if I, as a content moderator, am compromised mentally, I get exposed to this content, there are no systems in place to actually make sure that I don't suffer from, let's say, PTSD, for example. And I'm saying this because I believe that there is actually a system that can be implemented. I'm not someone who actually goes in public and complains about something whereas I don't have... In fact, it's not about going to public. I wouldn't even go to my mother or grandmother to complain about something if I don't have a solution, and expect them to actually come with the solution. So I actually believe there's a solution. Now, if I'm compromised, this is a content moderation, because you are not one working on, if you don't know this, a system, working on finding better ways of dealing with this problem, just to make sure that I at least do not suffer so that I am able to perform at my level best. Best believe I'm going to get it wrong. Best believe that problematic content is going to end up on social media platforms, and then suddenly there's misinformation, and then suddenly we have people lying, we have chaos all around, people fighting, people killing each other, which is what is happening right now. And the bigger difficulty is that, and this relates to my journey actually, is that once you get compromised, one, you are coming from a poor background. Two, they are not paying you well. Number three, they're not providing you with the necessary mental health care support that you need. You are actually, even when you feel like this is actually not working for me, you are not going to leave the job because you have nothing else to fall back on. Poverty is not a beautiful thing.
Sorry to interrupt.
Right.
Mark, I wonder if you recognize in what Daniel has just said there a strategy that Uber was using when it came to hiring its labor pool. What Daniel was saying about, you know, if you don't want to work for us, we can discard you and somebody else will. That sounds quite a lot like the systemic pressures reducing worker wages in a gig economy setting.
Well, the thing about Uber is that, you know, Uber said to investors, we will be profitable because we won't own the cars and we won't employ the drivers. And every time we went into a city, we were so successful because there were so many people out there on the margins, either having a job but needing a second job in order to make ends meet, or not having a job because they didn't have university education. But you know, it's fairly straightforward. If you have a driving license, that's an accessible opportunity to sort of get your foot on the first rung of the ladder. And we did the marketing of this opportunity as if people would be entrepreneurs. It was so cool. And being part of this, you know, if you can remember the days when Uber was really cool and front page news, and everybody wanted to be a part of it, whether they came from, you know, MBA school or they came from the rough neighborhoods of some of the cities. But to us, they were just supply. And if drivers didn't comply with our demands in terms of how much they would work, when they would work, then they were expendable. We would just replace them because there were so many people queuing outside the door. But to take it a step further, you know, we had invested $5 or $6 billion in autonomous cars, in self-driving cars. So at some point in the process, and we believe that we would have self-driving cars by now, by the way, it's taking more time, but it's going to happen, we wouldn't need the human beings. So they were just a short-term requirement in order to build the company, in order to scale the company. You know, Uber's technology wasn't unique. It was using smartphone technology that has this interconnected mesh of users in a metropolitan area. So once you connect, you can intermediate between supply and demand, you can move people around, you can move food around, you can move parcels around, you can move medication around, and you have this captive market. But we used investor dollars to displace the existing incumbent, and we intended to own the market and operate as a private monopoly. So the drivers were always expendable, but we were perhaps, in a sense, more malicious than the likes of Meta or TikTok, who have these arm's length relationships with content moderators, usually through subcontractors. And it's the sort of the stuff that they hide behind the curtain. You know, we were very clear about the fact that we would not pay basic social protections to these people because they were so proud to be their own bosses. And I think that's, it's, you know, I highly recommend Martin Wolf from the Financial Times, his latest book. It's the breakdown in this yin and yang between liberal democracy and market capitalism. If you have this rush for greed, you have this unfettered capitalism where the regulators absolutely are outgunned, outmanned, vis-a-vis these tech behemoths in Silicon Valley, you're going to have the likes of Uber, which is exhibit A in how you weaponize investor dollars and you weaponize the legal system to destroy the social contract and to remove workers' rights. And, you know, back then we thought we hyped the sharing economy. You know, we could use technology to give lots of people opportunity, the gig economy. But now the gig economy, rightly so, is considered as something very pernicious, something very negative, because you go outside in the street this evening, you'll see all the Deliveroo people, you know, working a hard slog, the Uber drivers, and they're not getting basically a proper treatment, and they're not getting a decent living wage.
Mm. And I mean, Daniel, Facebook is a multi-billion-dollar company. I mean, they would say that you know, they spend billions of dollars a year on keeping their platform safe, that it's a cost for them. They're not necessarily profiting directly from having content moderators keeping the platform safe, removing malicious content. But in some ways, it's quite correlated with how successful a platform is, right? What do you think about that?
I believe that actually the entire business model of social media companies is actually based or survives because of content moderation. Without content moderation, I don't think the model would survive. So if I own a business and content is not moderated, problematic content gets online. And I believe that actually the majority of people in the world are not people who like horror movies and all of those things. No, it doesn't work like that. In fact, most people actually don't want to see content that is traumatic to their mindsets. So if content moderation wasn't there, and then problematic content or traumatic content or I'm trying to think of another word, but anyways, I think I've made my point. If it was freely flowing on these platforms, I wouldn't want to invest in those in those platforms to advertise them. Why would I do that? Because no one would actually be going to those platforms. So I'm not going to gain anything as a business person. So the entire business model actually survives on, because you can even go and look and look up how Facebook began. So how Facebook began okay, initially it was just about connecting people. Then it became the question to monetize the platform actually came. And then when this question came, moderating content actually became a problem for Facebook. And so that is how content moderation was actually born. So the entire business model is actually based on cannot survive without content moderation. And I just want to say something about, because as someone who was working as a content, it's a labor question right now. It relates to what we're saying right now. Corporate companies are not actually interested in empowering ordinary people, poor people. So they come and make these claims that they're actually empowering poor people. That is not actually the case. And this is where it gets interesting between this story and my story, because I am speaking actually as a content moderator. Well, you can say former, but as a content moderator, someone who was actually saying, I needed to get food from this, I needed to succeed from this, and I needed to make sure that my family gets taken care through this and maybe build wealth through it. But it's not happening. Why? Because no one at Silicon Valley is actually interested in that. They are only seeing us as a temporary measure. And I'm saying this because I've been asked a question as to whether I think human content moderators should continue to exist when AI can come and actually do the job. So it's sort of like there's this push to replace content moderators and human labor. And my position is this when it comes to actually AI replacing human beings. Actually, AI is actually trying to replace all of us. So in the end, if nothing is done about it, none of us are actually going to be working. And that is a situation that is actually unsustainable from an economic point of view. Okay, let me stop about economics. I don't know about that. Let's do content moderation.
Yeah, but just if I can just jump in here. If you had asked an Uber driver 6, 7, 8 years ago how they felt, they were delighted. They were proud. They were part of something that was really cool. A global phenomenon, and they were making decent income because we were subsidizing the rides. So they were going home with a very decent income, and at the same time, the consumer was paying a very low amount. You speak to your Uber driver today in Paris, in London, in Frankfurt. It's not the same narrative. So it was very short-termist. It was very self-serving. When it suited us, we told them that they were the champions. That we would do these onboarding sessions. We would train them. We would give them all this amazing swag. We would give them iPhones worth, $1,000 or $800 at the time, and made them what was duplicitous. If you pushed aside the economic aspect, it was making them feel part of something. And now Uber drivers complain that, my boss is a robot. It's algorithmic management. If they have any concerns or if they want to speak up, we used to have private investigative teams to infiltrate their WhatsApp groups, to infiltrate their Facebook groups, because we didn't want them to collectivize. We certainly didn't want them to unionize. We didn't want them to have leverage. We didn't want them to have power. And as Daniel was saying, in poorer countries, the content moderators are expendable and they can be easily replaced because there's a lot of people out there looking for economic opportunity. I also would, just to finish this point, lay a lot of blame at two doors. One is the regulator, governments. I interface with ministers, presidents, prime ministers, and in many cases, they were so keen to have this cool tech come and set up in their country with the prospect of jobs, the prospect of tax receipts. Apart from Uber's own employees, maybe 10,000 across the world, Uber hasn't created any jobs, real jobs. In terms of tax receipts, Uber hasn't created a single cent in tax receipts in the European Union and devised all sorts of strategies to dodge HMRC here in the United Kingdom. But also, I would lay a lot of responsibility at the door of the investors, the venture capital firms, who gave us the money with no conditions and stood back. There really were no adults in the room. And you've got to wonder how people can look at the front pages of fires burning in Paris, of huge taxi strikes here in London. In South Africa, I was getting calls from my team down there. Drivers were getting shot. Drivers were getting killed in South Africa, in Johannesburg, in Pretoria, in Brazil, in Mexico. And nobody was coming in and saying, hang on, guys, we need to calm this down and figure out, is this the kind of business model we want to be a part of? And of course, all those investors sold out prior to the IPO. A very small number of people did extremely well. But there's a quote from a dean of philosophy at the University of California, Irvine, who calls it asshole capitalism, that there are some citizens out there who believe that they have this divine right to personal enrichment regardless of the social cost. And I think there's got to be a reckoning.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, you think about the impact of both Facebook and Uber in the world, and both companies sold a narrative, right? Facebook is you'd be connected to your friends. Uber is that, you know, you can provide great work to people who need it on the margins of the economy while providing a service to consumers.
Right.
In both cases, I mean, Facebook seems to have pivoted away from connecting people's friends towards putting viral content in people's feeds as a delivery mechanism for targeted advertising, right? And it seems like it was that decision that necessitated the huge quantities of content moderation that is happening today, right? Same for Uber. I mean, I don't know about everyone here. I use Uber occasionally. I try not to. But when you try and order a cab on the app, sometimes it'll cycle through 5, 6, 7, 8 cabs. I don't, maybe you have an insight into this, but it seems to me as if they've set the price artificially low to the point where 6, 7, 8 drivers are rejecting it because it's low. And instead of saying, okay, therefore we need to raise the price up, they just continue giving it until somebody, the lowest common denominator, will accept the ride, instead of just saying to the consumer, pay $1 more.
But that's control that Uber has over the drivers, except that they denied in court this sort of subordination because they, you know, if it looks like a duck, if it walks like a duck, if it says quack, it's a duck. You know, it's not a unicorn. And these people should be treated as employees. So they have, you know, they can't make an honest living because Uber is setting the price. You know, Uber, there's a law being finalized at the level of the European Union. Finally, a platform workers directive to give basic social protection to up to 40 million platform workers around the European Union. And I'm not talking about, you know, really comfortable pensions and sick pay, just the basic minimum. And Uber is spending millions fighting this. And their head of Europe was front page in the Financial Times a couple of weeks ago, said, well, if you go ahead with this law, we'll be forced to pull out of many European cities. Drivers are going to earn a lot less, but investors, Wall Street, don't worry, we will maintain our profitability. And that's the sort of bullying, corporate bullying, that I'm just surprised that after WeWork, after Theranos, after Uber, after all these scandals, after how content moderators have been treated, people think it's still okay to behave like that.
Mm. So I want to talk about whistleblowing a bit, because that's kind of why we're here. Why don't you, Daniel, tell everybody about the decision that you take? I mean, that you took. I think it was after an email that I sent to you, although you may have come to the feeling that you wanted to blow the whistle before that.
So the word whistleblower, or rather the title, even though I'm actually struggling to actually accept or see myself as one, right? And for me, it wasn't even a question of a decision. It was, I just found myself in a very difficult situation, which I could not stand anymore. Which it was a matter of life and death for me. So it was either I choose to live or die. So I'm saying this because back when I was actually in Nairobi trying to unionize, I was actually trying to stay within, not to lose the job. Remember, I'm running away from poverty. Another time, I didn't actually know that I knew that there was something wrong with me. I could feel that there's something wrong with me, but I didn't know what it was. I don't think there's anyone who can wake up and say, I have PTSD. No, it doesn't work like that. But I was actually fighting to stay within. I just got fired, right? And coming from a very poor background, it actually is very difficult to get to a point where you make the decision to do something, you would feel like I want to do something, but who are you going to tell? What are you going to do? Who are you going to pay to actually get somewhere? So in more ways than one, your story actually sort of like took the decision for me. I was just willing because I actually, I always felt like I need to do something about this because I'm that one person that you, okay, I'm not violent. Yeah. You're not going to kick me and then I'll just look at you and say, it's okay. No, it's not okay. You must know that it's not okay. So if you do something, I feel like I have a moral obligation. The same way that I feel today, I still have the a moral obligation to actually do something about this. Because the problems that I experienced, the problems that I faced, the PTSD that I'm actually suffering from and recovering from today, someone else is actually fully getting it today. Someone else is still actually suffering from it today. So it was a question of me simply choosing life, I think.
So when you made that decision, did you know what was out there in terms of whistleblower support, in terms of the, you know, the facilities available to you?
No, I didn't. I didn't. And I think that's an interesting thing about this entire thing, because some of the things, you come across them or discover them because of what life is doing to you or what is happening to you. Everything, I think I'm sitting here because life happened to me. I became a whistleblower because life happened to me. The support I received because life happened to me. And to go back a bit, I became a whistleblower because I like to say that I was discovered. So everything that is happening to me, it's because of discovery. Because it is very sad that in the world today, we have all of these problems. And as we have all of these problems, the people that can actually help us, like the Signals Network, for instance, the odds are actually stacked up against them, the same way that they are against us. So it's difficult for them to actually say, okay, we are going to have that big of a global reach so that everyone in the world gets to know about us. So if you go, maybe in South Africa now people know because they get to read, oh, Daniel, yeah, and support from Signals Network and all of that. But because of how the system has been designed, it simply is impossible. Really difficult for one to actually get to a point, okay, if I experience this kind of problem or I'm whistleblowing, or even if it's a decision, maybe these are the kinds of resources that I need to tap into. I can actually talk to XYZ so that I can make sure that at the very least there's safety. At the very least, as I do this, there isn't a gun pointing at the back of my head pointing at me. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mark, I wonder if you tell your story about only talking to the Signals Network 1 hour before you went public. What advice would you give to yourself about that if you could do it again?
Don't use me as a case study. I mean, I don't know who I'm misquoting here, but the decision to blow the whistle to became sort of gradually, suddenly, and then all at once. And you talk about moral obligation, you know, from talking to a specific driver in Malaga who had driven me from place to place for 50 minutes and understanding his economics and what he was taking home, I thought to myself, you know, that's just wrong. And I resigned from Uber because at some point it's like being in a really bad movie when you have to have bodyguards. You know, I was head of public policy. But I had a good relationship with the company. I believed in the project. And then over time, as I said before, the economics, the really putting the burden, the financial burden on the backs of these drivers that we were praising, we were lauding, it just seemed to be, to not seem to be, it was just wrong. But I'll tell you something that I haven't actually said publicly before. At Christmas 2021, I had some friends from, you know, I come from a very small place in the west of Ireland. They had come to visit me in France for Christmas, and it just so happened that one of them was a journalist for The Guardian. So she saw that I was struggling with with the need to do something to set the record straight. So I had a Zoom call between Christmas and New Year 2021 with Nick Hopkins, who used to be the head of investigations at The Guardian. And he'd done Snowden with Glenn Greenwald, and he really knew what he was talking about. And for about 45 minutes, he didn't ask me what I had, what was the skinny, what was the scoop. He talked about me, about did I know what I was doing? Was I in a good place mentally? Did I have family? Was, you know, was I putting anyone else's livelihood on the line by basically throwing away an entire career? And for the first 6 months of 2022, I worked almost on a daily basis with the investigations team at The Guardian. And they explained to me that, you know, if you want to speak to a lawyer, of course you should do that. They were extraordinarily professional, but I just had this bond of trust with them. And once they realized what was in the data, I mean, I was reading about the Panama Papers, which was the equivalent of 500,000 Bibles, you know, 1.9 terabytes. Mine was only about 250 gigabytes, but it's still 50,000 Bibles. And once they realized that there was a lot in the data across a huge amount of countries, they took it to ICIJ in Washington, 40 media organizations, 180 journalists, the rest is history, as they say. And the quid pro quo, because they were terrified about a leak, that somebody in Argentina or Australia or India would write and publicize something before everybody was ready to go on that. When they do these global investigations, they usually publish the first salvo on a Sunday night. Miraculously, the story held. Miraculously, Boris Johnson left 10 days previous, so he wouldn't take the front pages. They had lined up various organizations for me to talk to. So 2 hours before I was revealed as a source, first of all, I called my family, and because they were seeing all these stories dropping, thinking, what have you been involved in? And I had this conversation with the Signals Network, and they were so calm, collected, structured, and I don't know how I would have survived without them. Since July of last year. So what is that, 15 months? If I were to speak to a potential whistleblower in the tech industry or anywhere else, if I had one message for them, I would tell them that you're not alone. There's a whole world that I've discovered of professional investigative journalists who have this amazing approach to determine what is and what is not in the public interest. So there, you know, that's a really important part of a functioning democracy. And there are these philanthropic organizations, these amazing voluntary organizations, NGOs, of incredibly talented people who get, you know, not paid very, very much money to really give all the legal advice, the media handling, the advocacy support to people like me. And of course, there's a big gap between how we view whistleblowers on this side of the Atlantic vis-a-vis the States. There's a longer history there in the public sector and also in the private sector. But I think, and Ida, as you were saying in your introductory comments, yes, we have a EU whistleblower directive. You know, as a whistleblower, as a European, I look at it and I think, that's all you got. But it's a place to start. And you've got PETA here in the UK, and you can build on that. But you discover that there's a whole family out there that you didn't know existed. You know, really amazing lawyers, human rights activists, and you know, I'm not recommending it as a career move. There are really brilliant people who are there to advise you, to guide you, to help you, and to help protect you.
Yeah. Daniel, any advice that you'd give to your self on the evening of, whenever it was, February 2022?
Any advice I give myself? That is actually a very difficult question because, like I say, for me, I was just backed into a corner and I had to get out of that corner. And after getting out of that corner, and getting out of the corner means that you actually have to, I would actually have to make sure that I heal and make sure that I fix everything that went wrong so that I can go back to the trajectory that I wanted to be on with regards to building myself and the career, right? The unfortunate part, I think, where advice comes is that for us, and I like the point that he makes about how whistleblowing is understood in different regions, is that for my specific purposes and where I come from, Africa, this thing of whistleblowing is actually, it's something that doesn't exist. It's just not there, right? So it would have been impossible for me, or in fact, it is a bit difficult for me to imagine how I would have advised myself, whereas this concept in itself is something that is not there. So I think what I can do or say is that, although it's really pointless to talk, I've actually reached a point whereby I think it's pointless to talk to policymakers right now, for a simple reason, because it's just not going to happen. So I know I'm not really answering the question. I'm studying something else, but I'll get back to it. So I attended this Paris conference where they were talking about the Digital Services Act, which basically is, I don't even want to talk about it. So I go there, and this is,
you know, we're being live streamed.
Yes. I want them to see and hear this. So I actually went I went there. When I get there, I think this is a point where I actually woke up, because I think I was in a state of illusion for quite some time, thinking that I go to a conference, policymakers are there, and maybe some representatives from these companies are there, and then we have a decent, nice conversation or talk about this, and then after that, yeah, we have actionables. We're going to talk about how we go forward from there. But I then discovered that actually people are there to go to the Eiffel Tower, take a picture, drink coffee, and then maybe have a beer, and then go back home, show people pictures or whatever. Whereas I went there, I still do that. But I'm no longer going to say, I think something actionable. I'm not saying it doesn't ever, but the reality is that most of the time, people who, key stakeholders, most people who go there to actually achieve something are CSOs, people who are actually on the ground doing the work that's necessary. As for policymakers and the powers that be, nothing really happens. And so the idea, which is why I speak of a bottom-up approach to a solution, especially when it comes to content moderation. And now I've even forgotten what the question was.
It's okay. I think we're going to open the floor up to, yeah, to some Q&A. So, if anyone has a question.
Eiffel Tower.
Thanks, both. Yeah. Yeah. If I could ask the same question of both, I'd be really interested to hear about the workplace culture that existed in both the places where you worked. So for Daniel, what it was like with your colleagues, what were the conversations that you all had between each other about what was going on, about what you were seeing? And for Mark, when you talked about that clash between liberal democracy and market capitalism, what was the culture and the conversations around that conflict that Uber were clearly at the front of? Thank you.
Daniel, do you want to go first? What was the workplace culture like at Sama?
Yeah, so, and this is actually frustrating about Sama or Sama Source, because if you read about Sama and how it began, it's a beautiful story. It really is a beautiful story.
Sama is the outsourcer, by the way.
Yes. So it really is a beautiful story. But now I think there's a quote that says, I think it's a quote by Lord Acton.
Yes. Going back a bit.
Yes. Now, he once said that power corrupts, absolute power corrupts, absolutely. So given this beautiful story of ethics and ethical AI and work and giving work and all that nice story that they were selling in the public, I get to Sama and then we get to some and then we discover that we are actually being treated like pieces of meat. We see ourselves suffering because those are the conversations. Some people doing this job, actually, you'd see people collapsing, you'd see people crying, people resorting to drugs, you're not sleeping, you're having nightmares and all of those things. And then we'd have conversations about this and say, look, and especially because we are poor, we're like, there's something wrong here. This is happening. I'm experiencing, I can't sleep. I'm having nightmares. You're also having those. Maybe we need to do something about this. You try and speak to them. They come and tell you, actually, you're worthless. You keep on talking about this, we're actually going to fire you and find someone else. That was the general culture. And the sad part about this, I think this needs saying, you find that, and I'm not sure if this is actually something that exists because I'm yet to find out. I'm actually yet to get to the Philippines and find out as to where the content moderators have been to, in terms of the workplace culture, especially under some, but I know some is no longer doing that. But I would have been interested in knowing that if they were being treated the same, because I have this feeling or belief that they were moving from Silicon Valley, they find managers in Kenya or Africa or the Philippines, and then they feed them this culture of saying, treat them this way. Because it is actually people and managers there who were saying these things on behalf of people coming from Silicon. So those who were coming from the Silicon, they would actually come and say the same thing, which is why I ended up with the idea that this is a culture that is actually coming from high up, and then it is coming to these people and being transferred to us, to us. And I'm a very reasonable person. Those people in Africa or the Philippines or whatever, the culture that they had adopted, they were actually doing it because when I assessed their situation from a distance, I actually discovered that we're actually in the same bucket. They themselves are actually functioning under the barrel of a gun. If you don't do X, I'll just find somebody else. So the culture was very toxic in that sense, in that in terms of mere respect, it's not there. You don't have respect for me, and then you don't pay me well. You don't even care as to whether I live or die, because you'll just find someone else. That's how it was.
Mark, I wonder about you.
The answer to your question, it was actually quite cynical. You know, I was brought on because there was so much controversy around the region. And so at the same time, Uber announced that they were hiring David Plouffe, who had been campaign manager for Barack Obama in 2008, then senior advisor to the president in the White House, really talented, amazing man. And they brought me on in Europe and said, okay, we're going to reset our relationship with government, with regulators, because actually the only place in the region where Uber was not breaking the law, and we used to say it was a gray zone, we were breaking the law willfully. The only place where we weren't was in London, where deregulation allowed for minicabs, and there was at least a licensing system with TfL. So we said that we're going to press the reset button, but at the same time, you know, we engaged in what I would refer to as crony capitalism, where to fix our problems, it was, you know, we text Dave and George, you know, David Cameron, number 10, George Osborne, Chancellor of the Exchequer. We'd use our relationships with them to counter the opposition from Boris Johnson, then Mayor of London. I was texting on a regular basis with Emmanuel Macron, who was Minister of the Economy. So we had this access to power that we didn't just get when we started as a startup in Silicon Valley, that we got from our investors. You know, it's Google introduced me to Macron. Google introduced Uber to Cameron and Osborne. So we had this disproportionate, I would say, uncompetitive access to power. And if you take it in American context, you know, I would say Valley, Hill, Street. Silicon Valley, Capitol Hill, Wall Street. The philosophy of the company at the time was it was straight from Valley to Wall Street, and the Hill needed to get out of the way. Government needed to just move aside. We had this sort of this Gandhi-esque approach that it's a bad law. So, you know, people need to accept that we're going to break the law because it's a bad law. And once you get enough consumers on your platform, then you can weaponize those consumers and also weaponize your drivers to push put pressure on policymakers to change the rules very quickly to suit us. So I think it was a very problematic in terms of democracy. It's we're our own worst enemies. You know, with unfettered capitalism, we can do so much damage by allowing people to willfully break the rules. And there were no sanctions. Drivers were fined. Drivers had their cars clamped, put in prison. Like I said, people were being shot and killed in various parts of the world. But there was no real accountability because it was the tech valley boom. It was venture capital throwing billions, which they were getting at the market at zero interest rates. And I think that while there's plenty in the media and all these stories have been told and retold, I don't think there's, I would agree with Daniel in terms of policymakers acting on the lessons learned. You know, what's the point in coming out and blowing the whistle if people are just going to read the stories, make a few documentaries, you know, make a TV series, and then just move on to dealing with the next problem?
I think that's the first time I've heard Uber compared to Gandhi. Yes.
We've had a great seminar here about Julian Assange, perhaps the greatest whistleblower I've ever seen, I think. Much of the world's ever seen. Yet he's in maximum security in Belmarsh prison. And what can you, Mark, and Uber and Signals Network do about getting him released unconditionally and not spending the next 100 years in the US or Australia?
I think that's a question for Jennifer, actually.
I'm actually talking about Julian Assange, right?
Yes.
Julian has a fantastic team doing some amazing work, including at Dowdy Street, on his behalf. So I don't know that he needs us, but if he needs us, we're on standby.
Why is he still in prison?
That is a question for another day and another panel and another topic. Next question?
That was a tough question.
I wanted to ask, what has changed since you have whistleblowed? That is, it's because a lot of scandals get comes out, and then when I follow it up a year later, 3 years later, it's forgotten about and nothing gets done. So it's just a story in the newspapers.
If I can jump in on that one.
Absolutely.
So I think that's something that we have to fix. You know, I have a career in public policy, and I believe lobbying is a legitimate part of a functioning democracy. I believe investigative journalism is. I believe peaceful civil disobedience is an essential part of a properly functioning democracy. Whistleblowing, which is kind of part and parcel of investigative reporting, right now there are isolated cases. Daniel Moton, Francis Hogan, Anika Collier, the Twitter whistleblower, me, many others, were isolated cases, and there has to be a way to collectivize or try and find a systemic approach where the sum of the parts actually has some sort, that it's not just a headline, a flash in the pan, a one-off, that you manage to build. I don't want to talk about people power because that's slightly twee, but you manage to actually build on what has been learned and how do you feed that into the policymaking legislative process so that you get better regulation. And it's that connection that's lacking. So, you know, the Signals Network is very huge in my life, but it's actually a very small organization that desperately needs, you know, good people to fund it, if there are any of them out there. They do brilliant work. And without this, the likes of the Signals work Network and Whistleblower International Network, the likes of me and Daniel are in great danger, huge legal jeopardy. You know, 2 days after I was revealed as a source of the Uber files, their lawyers wrote to my lawyers saying that they were going to sue me based on my confidentiality agreement, $30,000 penalty a day. The clock is still ticking. They haven't withdrawn the threat. So I think we're about 22 or 23 million euros right now. So funding the likes of the Signals Network and other whistleblower organizations is one step, but actually drawing the work that they do with the individuals together into some corpus that actually can have impact on people in the House of Parliament, people in government. I think that's I'm not seeing that, and I think that's perhaps something that we could all be a part of.
I think one thing that has changed is the reputation of these tech companies, pretty much by and large, is not as beneficent as it was 10 years ago, even 5 years ago. I mean, Uber isn't seen like the good guy anymore, right? And I mean, I think the phrase you used was just a story in the newspaper, but it's the stories in the newspaper that have that impact on, you know, giving riders, Facebook users, a more kind of full knowledge of what platform they are interacting with economically. So I think we shouldn't discount that necessarily.
So the one thing I actually want to add to that is that why things don't change. Well, but they are going to change because it's not like we're going to stop. So we're not going to stop. We're going to continue until it changes. And I agree with what he's saying, that it goes back to the bottom-up approach thing. Because here's the thing. We are living in an elitist system. You've got politicians, or you can even say policymakers, and then you have corporate power. These two people are actually sharing this pie. So it becomes extremely difficult to change anything when they are still benefiting from it. Mm-hmm. And so we're talking about only a few people who are actually benefiting from this. So change becomes very difficult when the rest of us are seeing this as a problem and not benefiting from it. When only a few people are actually benefiting from it, that's the problem. The only thing that we can do and should continue to do is that, because I don't think it's acceptable to say, oh, well, things are not changing, so let's just not do anything. As I do what I do, I truly believe that change is going to happen. Sometimes I'm a bit naive, and over-optimistic, that it can actually happen in the next year or 2 years. And I'm saying that based on strategy. I'm not just saying that because I'm like, I hope change will happen. No, that's not how it happens. How it happens is that I systematically think about this in terms of how can civil society organizations, how can all those people who really care about this, whistleblowers, you can name them. How can we come together and actually make sure that we end up with a solution? How do we make sure that the people that support us, the likes of the Signals Network again, how do we make sure that they actually have the necessary resources that they need so that we continue to do our work? Society needs to support them because, no government is actually going to support them. Mm-hmm.
Jasper, I see you have the microphone.
Hello. As a tech journalist, I'm a big fan of tech whistleblowers.
Me too.
Shockingly. But I have a question about, so both of you have gone through quite significant personal costs to, doing what you've done. It's been tough emotionally, potentially financially. What is your opinion on systems which actually provide financial rewards to whistleblowers when they do this? Because they exist in certain industries, certain places. I'm not sure what a system would look like, but obviously that is a way to generate more whistleblowing and also compensate whistleblowers. But again, there's probably a range of moral hazards there as well from doing that. What are your opinions about the potential for governments, let's say, or regulators actually offering rewards for whistleblowing in various ways? What's your take on it? Do you think it's a good thing or a bad thing?
Can you rephrase the question for me, please?
So, for example, in America, the SEC will give a whistleblower, I think, 20 to 30% of a financial settlement that comes from a lawsuit as a result of a whistleblower's claim. Do you think that a system like that is a good idea, or does it introduce perverse incentives?
Here's the thing. That kind of sounds like, to me, if someone needs a kidney, I have to be paid to donate my kidney to them, type of thing. So in order for you to do the right thing, you must be paid to do the right thing. I don't think, and I'm talking about this because it's sort of like, and we are being portrayed as people who do this for money. We don't actually do this for money. We don't do whistleblowing because I'm expecting a payout from a settlement or whatever. So That, I have an issue with that. I have a bit of an issue with that. Now, in terms of systems that are there or that exist, there aren't any systems that exist, because whistleblowing is actually something. If you're going to whistleblow, expect poverty. You're going to be poor. No one is actually, except for organizations such as, I can tell you now that I was actually receiving a stipend from TSN, because I was in a very, very difficult financial position, in a very, very difficult mental health care position. So government is not interested in doing this. Corporate companies are not interested in doing this, because it does not serve their interest. So it goes back to this elitist system that I was talking about. I know, excuse me, I know that I can speak about my government, South Africa. South Africa, for example. So people actually get shot for whistleblowing. People get shot for whistleblowing. And who talks about this? The media talks about this. Do we have a bill that, if they go to parliament to actually talk about this, it's sort of like they are doing it because sometimes I feel like when policymakers actually talk about something, they only talk about it for show, not necessarily to get anything done. For the most part, because we can talk about these two stories right now. Policymakers are actually not, they do talk about it. I actually spoke to some MPs here last when I was here about, what do they call this bill again? The
online safety bill.
Online safety bill. Yeah, I saw my name come up in that conversation. But now where are we? Where is that conversation today? Mm. That's just how it is. That is why it is important for us to actually come up with an approach whereby CEOs, activists, whistleblowers, we actually come together to force the hand. And when I force the hand, when I say force the hand, I'm saying this because when it comes to content moderation, I believe we can actually do that.
What do you think? I think, you know, I'm well aware of the programs in the States, SEC, DOJ, et cetera, Department of Treasury. There's an interesting phrasing in the UK law, PIDA, that says wrongdoing is not necessarily the same thing as illegality. Okay. You could have a whole debate about that. But I think if I have to come down on one side, I think it's a perverse incentive. And I would like, you know, a couple of weeks ago, maybe 2 months ago, the press reported the single biggest ever whistleblower payment in the history of the SEC, $285 million, to an anonymous whistleblower who led to Ericsson, the telecom manufacturer, being fined by the SEC for continuing to export and sell telecom equipment to Islamic State, to ISIS, in huge breach of all the various sanctions law. And so some individual, courageous but anonymous, John Doe, has walked away with $285 million. When I look at how poorly resourced the Federal Trade Commission is, the SEC, Ofcom, these regulators, the laws are one thing, but having the firepower to execute and implement the law is another thing. So I would rather the money and the resource go to staffing these regulators, because you've seen time and time again the fines that are imposed upon Google, upon Facebook, it's pocket change. It's at best 1 or 2 weeks profitability, and it doesn't change anything. So, you know, pre-whistleblowing, I had headhunters on the phone every week. I've been ghosted by the entire corporate community. Fine. But I'd rather, you know, look at myself in the mirror and be relatively poor than walk away with hundreds of million dollars. I know there's a lot of U.S. law firms that are quite active on the scene here in London trying to push for reward system in the U.K. system. I don't want to oppose that, because I want to encourage whistleblowing, safe whistleblowing, so keep people safe and not have to throw away their livelihoods. But I think ultimately money is a perverse incentive for doing the right thing.
I would just add very quickly on that. the U.S. reward programs take years to pay out. So in terms of deferring the costs of someone like Daniel, who has immediately lost his job, can't eat, can't feed his family, you know, can't afford to live somewhere, they're not a solution, even if they were open for someone like Daniel, and Daniel wouldn't have had an SEC claim, right? It's quite a narrow form of whistleblowing that would have that kind of claim. And so one of the things the Signals Network has done, which Daniel referred to, is set up a fund to try to defer the cost of whistleblowing for whistleblowers. And we're growing that fund, but the idea being that there are any number of costs a whistleblower incurs immediately upon blowing the whistle. And there's not any safety net there right now to defer those costs. And it's one of the biggest barriers. The number of calls I get where people are trying to figure out what to do but need to be able to eat and probably don't blow the whistle because they don't have a safety net in place to be able to eat when they lose their job is significant.
Yeah.
One more question? Two more questions? Do two more. Maybe you both can ask them all.
Hi, well, thank you. It was quite interesting. My question is for Mark. So you're saying you've suffered from coming out as a whistleblower. And so my question is why not stay hidden in a way? Do you think your life could have continued without anyone knowing? Or do you think coming out allows for your argument to have depth and to continue like you do in conferences and have influence?
I'm not sure I have influence, but we had a very serious conversation with the investigations team at The Guardian. Some of the journalists in the room will know this, but prior to publishing such stories, the media issue so-called right of responses to the named parties. So there was something like 140 named parties in the revelations, whether individuals or corporate. And they received Q&As, substantial Q&As, a couple of weeks before the stories went live. And that's a legitimate right of response. So I said to The Guardian, I said, look, I'd rather stay anonymous, but would it add more credence, credibility to what you're publishing for you to name the source of the data? They said, look, it would be just so much stronger for us to be able to say this guy, former senior executive, and it wasn't some anonymous data dump. And the second thing is it would have been difficult to stay anonymous because contrary to, for example, Francis Hogan's Facebook leaks, Francis took pictures on the screen of documents, so 20,000 pictures, and it was difficult to navigate that data. The Uber files, it was, 200 gigabytes, 127,000 documents, including text messages, WhatsApp messages. So it wouldn't have taken a long time for Uber to join the dots and say, okay, who was the guy in the room in Davos? Who was the guy in the room in, in the Elysee Palace? I was going to be outed at some point. And having already come out before once in my life, you don't want to be outed. You want to stand up and do it yourself.
Mark, I have a question for you. How was your experience working with 108 journalists? I guess, if one journalist has got hundreds of questions on documents, having a consortium of people working on the same documents must have been quite challenging. And also, how did you actually transfer the files from your inbox to The Guardian, if you can say?
So the first part of the question, thank goodness I didn't have to work with or interface with 180 journalists. This is where Paul Lewis and his team, and Paul especially at The Guardian, did a brilliant job. They were my interface, and behind them there was ICIJ and all the various publications in 40 countries, 40 media organizations. I was shocked. For example, the Washington Post wrote a story that they had 50 journalists, 50 journalists in the Washington Post going through the data. But I didn't have to answer the phone to all of these journalists. Everything was funneled, everything was channeled through the Guardian investigations team. And I think on the back of the Snowden work, they had received more investment from the Scott Trust to hire more people. I'm delighted that on the back of the Uber files, they received even more funding to hire even more investigative journalists at The Guardian. So that's definitely a good result. To answer the second part, but it's also enhances the answer to the first part, I didn't want to just drop data and then move on with my life. I felt that if I was going to do this, it had to be done properly. I don't know what it's like to work inside a newsroom to be a journalist, and I didn't want to assume that a journalist knows what it's like to work in a corporate entity, but I wanted to help navigate during the data. All the data. At the time, you couldn't fly from London to France because of COVID restrictions. And also, I think, you know, Macron was trying to make it difficult for the Brits as punishment for Brexit. So we had to meet in a neutral location. So they flew to Geneva. A guy in a van drove me up to Geneva with all my two big suitcases of laptops, hard drives, all my Moleskine notebooks. I take excessive notes all the time. It drives lawyers crazy. So I have all these contemporaneous notes. It's as if I planned at some point in the future to blow the whistle, which I didn't. And I remember standing up and saying to them, I'm not sure there's anything here that's really of value to the media, but you know, here you go. Apparently there was so much there that they decided then to take it to ICIJ, with whom they'd worked on previous affairs. There's a system within ICIJ, so-called iShare, where all the data is uploaded. It's emails, PowerPoint presentations, Excel spreadsheets, all the text messaging history, the WhatsApp history, a warning to politicians everywhere. While you may be able to lose your WhatsApp history, Boris Johnson, if you're on iMessage, it's backed up and it's very difficult to get rid of. So it was all different types of data formats. And they had built this system post-Panama Papers to enable journalists all over the world to be able to access the same data in real time. I learned a lot.
Fantastic. I mean, I think that's all we have time for, but stick around. There's glasses of wine behind the bar. So, yeah. And nibbles, I think, downstairs.
Yeah,
is that right?
I think they're bringing nibbles, food up and drink, so please stay, have a glass, keep the conversation going. And thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Well,
I bought the only thing that I bought is that hoodie. And that's all. I actually wanted to buy a jacket, but I then discovered that London is actually very expensive. So I ditched that idea. I was like, okay, I was just amazing.
I agree.
That's like a better
ask the Reuters guys. It's a good